Hi, my name's John Carosella, and I'm your host for Convergence on Firefly Willows LIVE. Convergence is to consciousness as gravity is to the material world. In small amounts, gravity is overwhelmed by every other fundamental force of the universe. But gravity has something nothing else has. It's cumulative. The more matter you collect, the more gravity you get, until it becomes the most powerful force of the material world. I think convergence is like that too. Only in this case, we're working with truth. The more truth we collect, the more convergence we experience. Connections, relationships, resonance of ideas and concepts, science and mysticism. Lately, big truths just seem to be coming together, even as many of the illusions around us are falling apart. As within, so without. As above, so below. I know I'm feeling it, and I'll bet you are too. For the next 90 minutes, we'll be exploring concepts and topics that, in some way or another, bring us around to a deeper truth. Join me and my guests for this week's experience of Convergence.
Hi, and thanks for joining us for today's program. Coming up, join John in conversation with Sonia Amrito Bibelos of IlluminatedWisdom.com. Sonia experienced a series of life-changing awakenings while she was working at a Silicon Valley software company. She has been offering spiritual, energetic healing and intuitive guidance to individuals and couples for over 10 years, supporting them to awaken and live their awakening in every area of their lives. Then, John talks with Zlata Dogolva, a teacher of Qigong and yoga, about the power of alignment and flexibility when joined with strength. Zlata has been traveling the world over the last 2 years, studying the more esoteric forms of yoga and Qigong. Zlata has recently returned from intensive study in Russia and China and will once again be available for bodywork, yoga, and Qigong here in the Bay Area. Plus, he'll offer a personal reflection on the lessons of humility. If you have questions or want to participate in today's program, sign in and join us in the chat room at blogtalkradio.com. Next up, the Firefly Willows LIVE Roundtable is an opportunity for all of our hosts to come together and share their thoughts, experience, and insights on a variety of topics. Listen in as each host takes a turn as moderator. Today's moderator is John Carosella with our topic, Strength and Alignment, Two Sides of Success.
Welcome to this morning's roundtable. I'm your host, John Carosella, with my co-host, Mildred Lynn McDonald.
Hello.
Deb Carosella.
Good morning.
And High C Lovers.
Hello.
So welcome, guys. Thanks for joining me this morning. Today, I would like to talk about strength versus alignment, or strength and alignment. When we go through life, especially when we experience times of difficulty, a lot of times we're taught to rely on our strength, right? To be strong, to be kind of rooted and stoic in our experience of whatever's going on. And when we're challenged to strive for a new achievement, or, you know, when you're working at a new job, there's a lot of strength, a lot of talk about strength and putting your shoulder to the wheel and efforting. And I can relate to that. I've done a lot of that in my life. I feel like that's been an MO for me. But recently I've been discovering something that seems a little different, and I'll call it alignment. And as I've been researching it and talking about it with others, I seem to be discovering that alignment is this mysterious thing that when you have it, the path forward becomes effortless, or at least nearly so. And I'm wondering what experiences you guys have about the contrast between when you apply strength, when you rely on strength, and when you apply or rely on alignment to move you forward through life. Typically, I guess we might think about it in terms of the challenges of our lives, but just generally in life, when do you apply strength? When do you apply alignment? What do these two things mean, and how do you use them?
Well, for me, alignment is a state of being, and strength would be an energetic vibration that I would use to keep myself in alignment. When I'm in alignment, I have a sense of inner peace and centeredness and fulfillment, but it doesn't mean that it's easy and effortless to stay in alignment or to be in alignment. So that's where I would use strength, and I'd like to preface it by saying it's a strength that took years to cultivate and to activate and to exercise. So when you're talking about strength in terms of applying effort or applying force or putting your shoulder to the wheel, that might have been an approach that I would have used in my earlier years, because from my perspective, that's what the messages that society gives us. But as I became older and as I discovered energy work and as I started to listen to my inner self and higher self, a different type of vibration that would define strength came into my consciousness. And it feels more like a pressure than a force or a direction of steering or moving. So that's how it manifests for me.
So like when you experience strength, you're experiencing, you said, a pressure. So I'm gonna try this. Mm-hmm. It's like a compression of yourself into the state of alignment?
It's a focusing. It's consciously gathering the energy, which shows up to me as energetic vibrations, and making a conscious choice of where to direct and focus it. And that's where the strength would come in. Because I may be receiving a lot of external messages, or I may look to external sources for validation, like many people would. And I may find that that validation or that external message is not in agreement with what I'm feeling in my heart or my spirit. So that's when I need to tap into this strength that I've cultivated over years to make the choice to follow my alignment. And that's what helps me move my energy so I can focus or redefine some form of structure that's going to support me.
Mm. And when we were speaking a little bit earlier before we came on the air, you know, I asked about internal versus external, and you said something about the voices could be internal voices, just not ones that are in alignment.
Yeah, based on what I've integrated in terms of my belief system. And where did I get that belief system? It could have been what I experienced in life and what I have chosen to make it mean, but that could be totally off the mark.
Mm.
That could be a result of numerous variables, external forces, internal forces, family of origin, societal pressures.
Traumas as a child. It might not be true today, though.
Maybe all the dots in the head are not connected. Maybe naive or inexperienced. That can manifest itself internally. And so you're also using that as a platform to bounce off your alignment also. Mm-hmm. So that's what makes sense to me right now.
So strength, not as resistance. Not as resistance to, but as a gathering of.
Yeah, that's fair. That's great, John. Yeah. Yeah.
Anybody else have a thought on this?
I'm not sure that my vocabulary and my personal experience meshes exactly. I have a tendency to operate instinctually, and I don't know if that means alignment or not. I've always, especially in times of pressure or crisis, distress, I have a tendency to become very instinctual. I operate from a very basic place, and it's what is my body telling me, and how can I maneuver through whatever this situation is and get to the other side. So it's almost like I don't know if alignment or strength is coming into play there. I don't know if it's a matter of just going back to basics, hunkering down, using the innate inner strength that we are either born with or that we have developed as we experience life and the trials and tribulations and the joys of life. But I have a tendency to operate from very basic places. What do I need to do at this moment to continue to get to the next moment? What has to be prioritized? What is extraneous? What will take me from here to the next step and allow me to continue to function? Allow me to not completely fold up. Allow me to not spin off into panic.
So for you, I think what you're describing sounds like it's a narrowing of focus.
Yes.
So you bring yourself to a place where you can move from here to the next step because the only thing you're focused on is that.
Pretty much, yes. Without...
Let's say it this way. You're not allowing anything to interfere with getting from here to the next step. If you have extra capacity left over, fine. You
right.
can do other things, but you prioritize that next step instinctively, and everything else, anything else that gets in the way of that falls to the side.
I think that's a fair way of summarizing it, yeah.
Do you feel strong when you do that? Or what is it like for you when you feel strong? What does that feel like?
What does it feel like? Well, it depends, I guess. There's the strength that I feel when I'm not being pressured, when there doesn't appear to be any kind of a crisis or an external event that I now have to confront or is confronting me. And that, for me, strength is solidness and centeredness. It's just a calm. There are no ruffles. There are no waves. It's just, I just know. And I am, and that's all I need.
And what does alignment feel like to you?
I don't know, actually. I don't know that I've ever explored it or been aware that I was in alignment. I don't know that I've thought about when I wasn't in alignment, unless I act and react very instinctually. And when things aren't right, my body tells me. I become ill in one form or another. I have to vomit or something happens. And that could very much be my way of understanding this is not where you need to be. This is not for you. Don't allow this. Don't go there. Don't continue on this path.
So your body basically says, you're not in alignment.
Right. It's like, we're not doing this anymore, right? It's like, this is not good for you. Don't do this.
Interesting.
And going through my teenage years and exploring the world and new relationships and so forth, I don't know that I would have ever considered it. Am I in alignment? Is this for my highest good? Should I pursue, I just knew that I can't continue to date this individual because it makes me too tense. I can't come home and throw up after having, supposedly an enjoyable evening.
Just so you all know, I've often asked Deb why she married me, and her best answer is, because you didn't make me sick.
So I don't know if that means that I am in alignment and you were my best choice, or or if it was just, I'm tired of this whole, shenanigans stuff, and yeah, he seems like a reasonable guy.
Well, <girl. laughs>
27 years later, who's the joke really on?
Exactly.
So maybe the way Deb was describing it, it makes me think that strength is the conscious awareness and application of alignment. Alignment is kind of the inner sense, like Mildred was talking about. And strength is the ability and willingness to act in the external world on that alignment that you become aware of. And I don't think you can have, you can have one without the other, but I don't know that it's necessarily very effective one without the other. Because it makes me think, thinking of the words very literally, it makes me think of somebody, say, working out and lifting weights to build strength. You can lift a lot of weight, but if you're doing it without a strong core or you're not keeping your back in proper alignment or in proper position, then you can still lift the weights, but you do a lot of damage to yourself and you have to exert a lot more effort and it's a lot more difficult. But if you're holding yourself in alignment, then it actually is less effort and it's far more beneficial to you and for you.
And more productive too.
Right. So the weightlifter can throw their back out and then have to go to a chiropractor in order to get back into alignment because they're not doing both of them simultaneously. And the person who goes to the chiropractor is not going to build muscle just by going to the chiropractor. They're then going to have to take what the chiropractor is helping to do and externally put effort into doing something to build the strength.
See, this is very interesting and illuminating
the way, Mildred, then you've talked about it, and the way you're describing it, I see. It reminds me a lot of yoga, where there's a posture that you're seeking that is both defined by its alignment and achievable through strength. Right? So you're trying to put yourself in this place where both strength and alignment are very present in your intention. And there's effort involved in both. So there's effort in discernment, discerning your alignment and adjusting your alignment. And there's effort in holding your body in that place of alignment so that you can experience it. And the weightlifter analogy is pretty interesting, because if you can lift a lot of weights, you can be really strong and not be able to use that strength at all if you throw your back out. So your arms and your shoulders are still really strong, but you can't lift any weight because it's not useful strength anymore. And so I was just wondering about, in our culture, when we feel that we need to be strong, right? When we're carrying heavy loads at work or in family situations, you know, family crisis, or just the chronic load of being in our culture, there's a lot of strength that's required there, so it would seem, and there's a lot of strength applied there. How might that strength be better applied through the conscious investigation of alignment?
Well, I think if you take the comparison between East and West, between yoga and bodybuilding, that what the alignment allows for, that you especially get in yoga, that you don't get by just doing, say, weightlifting or bodybuilding, is flexibility. And so alignment brings flexibility. So whether it's that literal aspect or what you're talking about in everyday life, being in alignment means that you maintain flexibility and adaptability to whatever comes at you or whatever is needed, versus just trying to force it through by the application of strength in order to get it done or to get to a goal or to get to a destination.
The other point about alignment, I know when I was doing life coaching, and I was always talking about alignment, alignment, alignment. And then some of my clients started to make the assumption that being in alignment meant everything went their way. Mm-hmm. Everything. They never experienced any challenges or anything that may be uncomfortable for them. And so we had to spend a lot of time repositioning alignment and focusing not so much on the events, but how we chose to move through and navigate through the events.
Mm.
And I always remembered that, because I believe for our listeners, that is a little trap that you could easily fall into, feeling that, okay, I'm in alignment. Everything should be coming up sunshine and lollipops. But that's not necessarily the way it is. And by doing that, you are robbing yourself of experiences where you can develop skills, you can develop other aspects of your personality and your being.
So alignment isn't discomfort avoidance. It's not a recipe for avoiding discomfort. Alignment is a recipe for managing experience.
Well, a word you used earlier that I think maybe is not necessarily the best word to use, and it may be because it kind of causes somebody to think the way Mildred was describing, is I don't know that alignment is necessarily effortless.
Hmm.
You know, when you get into alignment and your higher self is saying, go down this path, that path may be the most challenging path you've ever had to walk down. And so it's not effortless in that sense. It just means if you've cultivated the strength over time so that you're prepared and ready for whatever path you end up going down, you have what is needed to put in and face whatever effort is necessary, rather than feeling as if you're not prepared or you don't have what is necessary to be able to accomplish or do or move down that path.
Mm. So to reflect on the aphorism that God never gives you a challenge you can't handle,
right,
kind of thing.
But
it doesn't mean that it's not challenging.
But you're being given a challenge.
Mm.
So it's not just all easy peasy and now it all just falls in place and I don't have to do anything, and you know.
So what is it? If it's not easy peasy, why would we seek alignment? What does that do for you?
Well, personally for myself, it's very fulfilling.
Fulfillment.
And I feel connected, a source of connection with my higher self, and the universe. It's a feeling to me that, it's going to sound hokey, but things are unfolding as they should. A sense of being part of a larger continuum, and also having faith that, number one, there's a bigger picture here. And I made a promise to myself, or I chose a belief, that my higher self will never let me down. Never. And I get a lot of strength from that inner knowledge that no matter what, my higher self will always be there with my best interests in mind. And if you ask, well, what's the purpose of alignment? Or that, for me personally, is what it is. It's that absolute 100% faith and trust.
That you can rely on your higher self because you're in alignment with it.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think that, one, it's that faith, it's the strength to know that even if you can't see where the end destination is, that this particular path is taking you, that your alignment or higher self has shown you, you have the strength to simply carry on and continue doing. And when you ask what alignment brings, like Mildred said, it's that sense of satisfaction or fulfillment. And you can see that, like in, say, a work or a career situation. So you can have somebody who has worked from the mailroom up to the CEO, and yet they're not happy. But externally, they can show that they're quote-unquote successful because the strength that they've put in to get to climb their way to the top is evident, but not being satisfied or happy even once you reach the top, to me, is an indication that, yes, you put the strength in, but it wasn't strength towards what is in alignment with your higher self. It's like the person who decides that they're going to be the accountant because it's safe versus the artist. They may become very successful as an accountant, but never really feel happy or satisfied or fulfilled by what they do, versus they do the artist thing. And even though it may not bring them the external aspects of what the successful accountant side did, they would be much more personally, internally, happier and satisfied and fulfilled doing what they love. And they may actually underestimate how successful they could be in something else because we get caught up in all sorts of things, but that actually goes to strength, which is having the competence and the esteem, self-esteem and all that kind of stuff to just believe in yourself and believe that things can be what you need and will be successful versus what the external world may say is the indicators of success.
Well, that's actually very helpful and very illuminating, guys. Thank you so much. I hope our listeners have enjoyed this roundtable. We look forward to our next roundtable hosted by the inimitable Mildred Lynn McDonald.
Thank you, John.
So thanks a lot, everybody.
Thank you, John. Thanks. Great topic. Bye.
Wave bigger so they can see it.
Well, that's our roundtable for this week. Many thanks to this week's moderator, John Carosella, and participants Mildred Lynn McDonald, Deb Carosella, and Heisi Lutmers. We hope you found this roundtable discussion engaging and thought-provoking. If you would like to join the conversation, visit facebook.com/fireflywillows and add your comment under this week's roundtable post. Stay tuned.
Okay, welcome back. This is Convergence, and I'm your host, John Carosella. And with me for this morning's spirited conversation is Sonia Amrita Bibelos. Sonia experienced a series of life-changing awakenings when she was working at a Silicon Valley software company, and later, while working for her spiritual teacher, Adyashanti, as his program director. She has been offering spiritual energetic healing and intuitive guidance to individuals and couples for over 10 years, supporting them to awaken and live their awakening in every area of their lives. And I have had the delight and the privilege of working with Sonia on some of my issues, and man, I can't tell you how incisive and insightful the conversations have been. And I would recommend Sonia pretty much to anybody. Because Sonia, your work is really powerful and it really works. So we're going to have a conversation this morning on a wide range of topics, but in particular, we're going to talk about your series, Becoming a New Human. And I just want to welcome you to Convergence.
Thank you, John. Thank you so much.
So, Becoming a New Human, I've seen the materials that you've put out. It sounds like a provocative topic. What does that mean? What does it mean to become a new human?
Becoming a new human came out of my own awakening journey. There was a point after a very deep awakening when I remember I was sitting in meditation and I was looking around my office and my meditation room, and I realized I had no idea what it meant to be a human.
This is very interesting.
Yeah. And I realized that all this time, all my ideas of being a human came from my ego projections, from really skewed ideas of not being whole or not being loved or needing to prove myself. And so now, knowing that I'm one and whole with the whole universe, the prospect of being a human opened up all these possibilities for me. And I realized that part of awakening is learning how to become a new human. And I remembered early in my awakening journey a talk Adyashanti gave. And I don't remember the whole of the talk, but I remember this one section where he said, you know, when we first wake up, we're like babies. We're like baby Buddhas. And we get up and walk and we fall on our faces. And that's the beginning of awakening. And I thought, wow, well, there's more than just being a baby Buddha. Then there's being a teenage Buddha.
Right.
And then there's being an adult Buddha. And
right.
we have to learn all these things the same way we need to learn when we're actually growing up. And I also realized that there's no end to learning how to be a human. You can be the most awake person on the planet and still have so much to learn about being a human, because there's no such thing as a perfect human. And so again, there's the infinite possibility of how to explore being a human.
So touch on that again. The things that prevented you from realizing your full humanness, what were they?
Mm-hmm. I think throughout my life, there were different things that took prominence at different times. And I can tell you about really debilitating insecurity.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you about the stories I had in my head that I had to prove myself in the world, or that I needed success to be worth something. I can tell you about stories I had in my head of shame. Or on, you know, all that kind of stuff from abuse in my childhood and whatever. All kinds of stories I had. And it works like this skewed lens. You know, when the lens was removed through my awakening, I was able to see just how skewed my whole perception of myself, my life, being a human really was. It was just like weird colors and angles and everything, you know, metaphorically,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And without that skew, wow, everything's a whole lot clearer and a whole lot easier.
But a lot different too, right?
And a lot different.
So that's hence the, you got to relearn a bunch of things.
Right, right.
And so are we relearning things, or are we learning things for the first time?
That's a great question. I think it's learning things for the first time in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
To some of the conversations you and I have had, John, the experience that you have when something falls away, an old habit, an old driver, set of drivers inside of us, and suddenly you have to make decisions in your life from a new place. What is that new place? Well, ultimately that place is truth. It's oneness, right? It's that wisdom, our individual wisdom that connects to the river of wisdom in all life. But we have to get used to making decisions from that place. And
yeah.
It's a new prospect. It's a new reality.
So how do you make decisions from that place? I guess that's part of the exercises that you are leading folks through in the series.
Yeah, absolutely. It inevitably is part of the exercises in multiple ways about different things. I'm calling people down to their deepest wisdom, calling people to connect into what I feel and believe is a part of their being that is already awake. In my experience, I see that waking up is in part shedding all this other stuff and seeing something new and seeing, you know, truth and God and oneness. But in part, it's also being in touch with what already knows the truth, what already is awake to oneness, to divinity, to all things. So part of what we do in becoming a new human is help people kind of connect into that. We do it through different topics, right? Different lenses. Different topics might have call forth different ways of accessing our wisdom. Like if we're talking about relationship, that's one way of kind of talking about wisdom or accessing wisdom and how wisdom moves in the world. If we're talking about career stuff or whatever else we might talk about, that we might talk about accessing wisdom and awakened awareness in a different way. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So it's interesting, the dichotomy that you highlighted. One is the awakening and awareness of the nature of divinity and of reality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a receptive principle awakening. And the other, you described as the connecting to the knowingness of the that which is already awake and has always been awake.
Yes.
And is that an active? Is that I'm looking for divine feminine, divine masculine here. If it's there, I'm just positing the question. Or are they both receptive principle feminine experiences?
I think they're both. I think they're
You just dodged the question.
I did just dodge the question. I think they're both masculine in a certain way. How do I describe this? This is a fine line that I realize people can struggle with, and I see it a lot in my clients. There's a way in which, in every facet of our awakening, we need to fully show up if we want to wake up, right? Sometimes it just happens to us. I have several clients for whom awakening just kind of happened, like, you know, a brick coming at them, you know, just happened. And everyone else didn't necessarily have it that way. They came in with a strong intention. There's something about that intentionality. There's something about that active, proactive saying, yes, I am going to drop away my ego, and yes, I am going to listen into that awakened awareness. So it's proactive. But there's another facet of it that's 100% receptivity. And you have to have both at the same time. Show up fully, be active, be alive, and be receptive. Surrender, because your mind doesn't know what you're looking for. The part that tends to be active, which is your mind, has no clue what awakening is really about. It thinks it does, but it actually really doesn't. And that's why receptivity is so important.
So why does the conscious, analytical, logical mind not know what awakening looks like or tastes like?
The mind, or the part of the mind that we're used to referencing,
right,
that mind is not designed to understand the universe. It was never built for that. It was built to execute life. It's built to analyze data. It's built to make decisions in certain ways, but it was never designed to be the primary driver, nor was it ever designed to understand the whole magnificent infinite universe, right?
Right.
And so it's like this other awareness that I'm sure is part of the brain. Right. And somebody else who understands the brain better than I do might have a brilliant thing to say about how the brain works exactly. But it's another part of our awareness that comes in that's bigger than our mental everyday mind that gets so constricted and locked in its way of seeing. And this bigger awareness takes everything into account. This bigger awareness sees the infinite. Right. And then that little analytical mind of ours just becomes a tool for the bigger awareness.
I'm soaking in that for a minute. The analytical mind was never designed to understand the universe.
Right.
Why the heck not?
That is a question for the creator of the mind. Because I don't know the answer. All I know is it can't. Because every time it faces the infinite, and I had this experience in my own self, every time the mind faced the infinite, it tried to make a story about it. It tried to make it something other than what it was. It couldn't recognize it. It couldn't see it. So I had to get past that little tiny mind, that part of my mind, and get into bigger awareness. I've actually wondered, and I would love to see if somebody's done studies about this, but I've actually wondered if it is also a whole brain. Like, more of the brain is activated when we see all of oneness, when we understand the universe, when that bigger awareness I'm talking about gets clicked on.
So I want to share a little story that I think has puzzled me, but has provided tons of fodder for rumination. It's really interesting. I was doing Zen meditation at Firefly Willows. Robert Jackson of A Quiet Mind was coming by and leading Zen meditation.
You
literally don't do anything. So I was trying to figure out how to crack this case. You know, like, what am I supposed to be getting out of this? How's it supposed to work? How do I know if anything's happening? Blah, blah, blah. And, you know, the discussion was, or the guidance was, don't do anything. If you have to do something, focus on your breath. And so I was trying to understand what that meant and how to do even that. And I got to this place where to focus on the breath, I mean, I could focus on it with my mind, but that didn't seem to work, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I started to feel my breathing instead of focus on my breathing, which is a very different thing for me. I don't know if it is the same for anybody else, but it was about feeling the breath. And I noticed that I would get distracted from feeling the breath by my internal chatter. And the internal chatter, so what I started doing was shushing myself. I'd be like, shh, you know, something, some word, some dialogue would appear, and I'd go, shh, 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 over and over and over, right? To myself, right? Not out loud. And I eventually got to the place where I realized that I even had to shush the emergence of a concept.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't words necessarily. Shushing the words wasn't enough. I had to shush the concepts. And when I successfully stopped conceptualizing, I got in this really weird place that totally surprised me. And it was very exciting and it was very cool. And it was, you know, samsara or whatever. I don't know I can't remember what the word is. It was
samadhi.
Samadhi. It was samadhi. And I was like, everything became one.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm.
And I thought, okay. Of course, I thought, wow, this is really cool. And then I lost it, right?
Mm.
But what I took away from that was there was a time in myth before things had names.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The story of Adam and the Bible and Adam naming things.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really understand the real gravity of that moment in human consciousness when we decided to name things, because it is in the naming of something that we distill it out of the one and make it separate. It's the creation, the moment of the creation of duality.
Mm.
And the naming function, so closely tied to the language function, is the left brain as we understand it in neuroscience today. So it was like, oh, it's the naming of things that creates the duality. It's the duality that prevents me from perceiving the infinite oneness. And that's what I got out of my Zen meditation.
That's perfect.
But, you know, so it was like when you say the ordinary everyday mind can't comprehend the universe, can't comprehend the infinite, I think it's because in attempting to understand the infinite with the mental model with the tool set that is our analytical mind, it is by definition an exercise in duality.
Yeah.
It has to extract it out of the substrate in which it exists, the background, mm-hmm. bring it into the foreground so that it can be focused on and perceptually disintegrated and articulated.
Mm-hmm.
The mind has to play with all of its edges.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but dude, it's the infinite. There is no edge. So the minute you try to give it edges, you fundamentally misunderstand it.
Mm-hmm.
You misapprehend it.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And I love that story, by the way.
It was a pretty cool moment.
And it is a perfect example of exactly what happens, that the mind is tasked with discerning variety. The mind is tasked with discerning differences and uniquenesses. It's not tasked with understanding that it's part of the oneness, because that would blur those edges. So when Adam named all things, there, you know, it's like in that moment, our brains were given the task of knowing all these names and knowing all this duality. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just that if you look there, if you look to the world of division, if you look to the mind that only sees the differences of things and can discern a lamp from a tree, that's not where you're going to find the infinite. It's in there, but you can't see it with your normal everyday mind that can only see the divisions.
So it's the lens of the analytical mind dropped in front of your perception,
right,
your consciousness, that filters out the infinite by definition.
Right.
Oh, that's really interesting, actually. So the trick, okay, the trick is to have one eye seeing through the filter and the other eye seeing without that filter.
Exactly.
And that's I'm starting to appreciate the creator's genius now.
Yeah, isn't that brilliant?
That's really cool because that's how it works, right?
Mm-hmm.
One eye is wired to one side of the brain, the other eye is wired to the other side of the brain. In fact, our hearing is also so similarly wired.
Right.
But our sense of smell, taste, and touch is not. Well, because those organs are not in stereo, I guess.
They're not in stereo, yeah. But, you know, one of my early awakening experiences, it was this very strange kind of mystic moment. I was on a silent retreat by myself for 3 weeks, and I was hiking in the Santa Cruz Mountains. That was it was a trail connected to where I was having my retreat. And I got up to the top of the hill, and I remember I had to turn around to go back to my cabin. And in the moment that I turned, suddenly all separation stopped, but I was discerning all these smells. It was like I could smell thousands of things and taste millions of things and hear and see millions of things all at once. It was the strangest experience, but I heard this little voice in my head say, "Don't stop here. This isn't everything." And so I just let the experience move through, and it was on the other side of that, when I dropped away the mind's discernment, that I was able to feel and know and be aware of the infinite, what is formless. So formless creates all this form, the millions of things I was seeing and hearing and tasting and smelling. Underneath all that infinite variety of form is absolute formlessness. Infinite love, all those things, just vastness.
There's another very interesting tie-in here, which is with quantum physics,
mm-hmm.
which I, you know, folks who listen to the show will recognize that I love to go here. the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum reality, the quantum layer, the quantum sphere. Niels Bohr and his crew. And this is really the current standing model of how physics understands deep reality, is that beneath the observable universe, what the limits of the behavior of quantum stuff, there is no deep reality. It's not that we can't see it.
Mm.
It's that it doesn't exist. And I think that means that it doesn't exist in an undifferentiated way.
Right.
It's only the void from which all things emerge past this line. It's like there's a road sign that says duality stops here.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
exactly.
And you know, on the other side of that is not smaller versions or more complex versions or more interesting versions of this reality, or even more advanced versions of this reality, that they're just actually past that point, there isn't anything.
Exactly.
And I was doing a deep meditation once where through a relationship with death, actually death happened to be hanging out with me during that whole experience, which was really cool, because I got to know death very well as a spirit being. He took me there. And I was in the void, unaware but aware, dead but alive. It was the weirdest place. It's so hard to describe because it's the Tao, right? It's not describable. There's no separation in it.
Exactly. I can feel from you when you're describing it that that the void, the phrase the void doesn't cut it. Like that's the best word we kind of have, but it's so much more rich than that. And I know that I experienced that. It is an absence of form, but it's not dead. It's not in and of itself. See, when we think of void, we think absence of all that is life. And even that's a duality. And the void is yet something else.
It is something different.
Yeah,
it is.
It is something different altogether. And I remember having to explain that for some of my Christian clients who asked me, what about this emptiness business? That feels really horrible. Because they were reading some Buddhist texts. And I said to them, it's not... when I experienced it, I remember thinking, oh, you know, these Buddhist teachers labeled it emptiness because they didn't know what else to call it. But it's something so much more than that. Every word we could come up with is a reference point to the world of form. So it's always going to sound like a contrast to something we know in this world of form, and it's all kind of inadequate
right,
in its expression.
Right.
Yeah, so I wanted to point that out.
Well, and it's interesting, again, on the front edge of physics, you know, we understand that electrons and positrons spontaneously emerge into existence.
Yes, right, exactly.
Right, and then they spontaneously disappear. And say they're coming from somewhere and they're going somewhere that we don't understand, that is beyond the quantum veil. And furthermore, the measurements that we've been able to make about the nature of the universe include calculations that something like 75% of the mass of the universe is dark energy and 20% is dark matter, which we don't understand and can't find. We can't, you know, take a scoop of it and examine it. And so, you know, it's, and there's all, you know, all kinds of like zero point energy and you know, the Casimir effect. And, you know, I'll have links for some of this stuff on the website for those of you who are interested. We are starting to experience in our physical reality real evidence of contact with the void, that we're somehow able to tease its effects at least into this reality without necessarily manifesting it materially into this reality, which is kind of, it's kind of like we're riding the surface of the ocean and we're starting to learn how to harness the waves, but we can't go beneath the surface.
Right.
Which is a really interesting place to, you know, I'm glad I'm alive right now because this is a really interesting place to be exploring reality from. Interesting vantage point. So we've gotten a little far afield from becoming a new human, I think.
Actually, what I like something that you said earlier, John, about, you know, it's like one eye, either metaphorically or literally, has to keep discerning the differences in our world of form here, the distinctions, and the other eye gets to see the infinite. The other eye gets to have the awareness. And I think that's part of the point of my class. I think that there are the program series. I think that there are teachers who emphasize 100% the infinite. And I think that's extraordinarily valuable. And there are other teachers who emphasize kind of mastering the world of form. I think that's extraordinarily valuable too. And I think in my experience, I love to hold both. I love the integration. I love that you can know that you are not the body you think you are, and yet appreciate and love this unique expression of the formless, that as it moves into form, that is your body. You can appreciate it all at the same time. I love the paradox. I love in how the two experiences enrich each other, the formless and the form. And that's why I created the program series. So it's actually not too far off topic, as you think.
Good.
Yeah.
That's good. You know, I've been wrestling with a lot of different aspects of beingness, being in the world, and stepping into the role that, you know, into the role of my highest purpose and all that kind of stuff that we all kind of struggle with understanding what it is, and then we struggle with stepping up to it and living it. And there's a part of the process that I haven't explored fully, but want to explore more because it consistently leads me to some cool insights. And it's that this is not about me.
Yeah.
That me living my highest purpose is not about me.
Yeah.
And so it makes the whole exercise less personal It makes the challenge less personally fraught with the notion of failure or the fear of disappointing others or myself or whatever, because if it's not about me, then I don't have to judge it.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes perfect sense. It's extraordinarily liberating. And I can affirm your experience with my own. I had the same experience realizing how much easier it was to just do what I was called to do, appreciate the gifts and talents I had, learn what I needed to learn to improve, whatever it is that I was called to improve, because none of it was about me. It just didn't matter. And so all of the, again, that skewed filter I'd had on everything with my ego, irrelevant, gone. And I was a lot more free to just do things, do my life, do whatever.
So how can it be not be personal when it's your body and your spirit and your highest purpose? On the one hand, I can grok that it's not about me.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it's like, but that doesn't make any sense. How can it not be about me?
Yeah, it's a great question. The way I think of it is that first of all, who is me? When we say, how can it not be about me? What is me? If the ego is saying, how can it not be about me? The ego likes to own everything. The ego likes to make everything about me. The ego likes to extrapolate huge conclusions about the universe, centered around the story of me. It's very narcissistic in that way, right? So if you take the ego out, and then you're just a being, you're a movement, a unique movement of life, you're a unique soul in the universe. Even your beingness is not about you, but it is unique to you. So I discern the difference between uniqueness, you are unique, there is nothing else like you in the universe, and that attachment and identification and all the stickiness that the ego has about being in this body and in this life, that stuff's all irrelevant. And the trick about talking about it is that it's very subtle. In a certain way, it's a huge difference when you experience it, but until you experience it fully for yourself, I'm talking about a very subtle distinction here. All we're saying is drop the way that you identify with who you think you are, drop your value assessment or your judgments about what you do, how you do it, etc. And what's left underneath that? There is something underneath that. There is something underneath all that identification and judgment and evaluation and all that. And that essence of life, the Christians call it a soul, right? That essence of life that's unique to this being called John, that essence moves through you and creates in the world. And because it knows it's part of the universe, and very specifically, part of the ecosystem of the world of form, it knows that nothing it does is separate from anything else in this ecosystem. And it knows, this consciousness knows, that it's not so much for personal gain. It's not about what the individual needs or requires. The individual needs are cared for as a whole ecosystem's cared for. There's not a separation between the individual and the whole ecosystem. Does that make sense?
I think so.
Okay.
And I think what we ought to do is take a short break.
Great.
And let our listeners digest that for a minute and then come back and go over some of that again.
Perfect.
So we'll be right back.
Enjoying today's show? Want to share it with a friend? Or maybe you've missed one of our previous programs. Well, you can always find the archives of our past shows on fireflywillows.com/live. Stop by and check out John's previous programs or shows from one of our other hosts, Mildred Lynn McDonald or Heisey Luttmers. Our live call-in shows are available, too. Join us.
Okay, we're back. This is Convergence. I'm your host, John Carosella, with Sonia Amrita Bibelos. And we're talking about becoming a new human and what that means and how you disentangle yourself from the old way of being human. And before the break, we were talking about letting go of significant slices of the ego to discover what's underneath it.
Mm-hmm.
And disentangling oneself from the ego. Certainly, most of our listeners understand the concept that, you know, the ego can get you into trouble. Right? And it's so it's not that we intrinsically resist the notion of disentangling, but how do you do it? You know, where do you, how do you take out the trash? And leave the good stuff, right? Because there's some, you let go of judgment, you let go of lack of self-worth, you let go of insecurity. There's still danger in the world. There's still, you still have a physical body. You still have to eat. You still have to clothe yourself and provide yourself with shelter. What happens when you excavate all of that stuff and you're left with this, whatever it is you're left with, the soul inhabiting the body? First of all, how do you do that? To the extent that you want to give us a, you know, short 2-minute primer on how to reach enlightenment, you know, we're cool with that too. But then, but like, what's the impact on you? How do you, what do you find yourself confronted with, and how do you proceed?
Oh, that's great. The first question about how to let go of the ego, I just think that's a hilarious question because, you know, you and I could do radio shows for the next 2 years every single week on this very topic. However,
Okay, so it's not that easy.
So you know what? It's not so much about hard or easy, believe it or not. What it is about is that that particular angle on the question, every single person experiences it a little bit differently. One thing I can tell you that's very helpful is that if you have a kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? When you're fighting against your ego, if you're in conflict with your ego and you want to reject it, you want to get rid of it, that kind of perspective or attitude is, it works like a rubber band. Your ego is just going to come bouncing back even stronger.
Okay.
Yeah, not so fun. I've been there. I know that one. It's not, not really a picnic. What I recommend instead is a spirit of surrender about it. The non-attachment, the act of non-attachment can start with your attitude even towards yourself. You don't have to, nothing is set in stone here. Have compassion for yourself. Have compassion for what the ego does or doesn't do and surrender it. You don't know what's underneath the ego, so just be willing to surrender it and see what happens. And there's a real kindness, both, again, the masculine action and the feminine receptivity, you know, in that act of surrender, too. So that's one thing. The other thing I'll say is rather than worrying too much about letting go of the ego, I mean, yes, I think most people need to address it. I'm not saying don't address it. I'm saying don't worry about it too much. I'd rather have people spend their energy dropping into the infinite, touching into what's already awake within them. Because in my experience, both in my own life and in many of my clients' lives, and even watching some of Vajrashanti students or my other spiritual teacher students, seems to me that when that fire starts, when we connect to the infinite, it kind of burns the ego away. You know, it starts its own momentum. Again, it's not 100% passive exercise. There is activity, there is participation, if you want to say it that way, in our surrender of the ego. But there's a whole lot that, you know, the infinite or God or whatever you want to call it is going to burn away the deeper you bring your awareness to the infinite. So it's like a byproduct of being awake is the ego lets go of itself. The ego surrenders. I dropped huge pieces of my habits and behaviors and identities and attachments without even trying. There were other things I really went through very consciously. But some things happened just because of the depth of an awakening.
Well, that's encouraging. That's really encouraging.
Doesn't
need to be a whole bunch of pick and shovel work necessarily.
It's not a bunch of pick and shovel work.
Or a bunch of resistance and tackling and tangling with something. It's just walking away.
Sometimes it is exactly that. And sometimes it is, and you've experienced this, John. I mean, sometimes it is really clearing out baggage. Sometimes it is burning things away in the fire. I've never totally understood why some things need to be a very conscious process. And some things are hardly conscious at all. They just fall away. They just drop.
something just lit up for me there, and that is that the things that have to be a conscious process are centered around wounds.
Often.
And things that we, that vaporize, things that go away without a bunch of effort, are artifacts or habits or programming that aren't directly related to our wounds. You know, like almost like karmic wounds, you have to heal.
Mm-hmm.
And everything else can just be, you know, shaken off.
I hear what you're saying. I'm feeling into it as you're talking, because I'm not 100% confident in stating like a rule about this. But when I feel into what you're saying, here's what I have seen, is that the stories we believe the hardest, the strongest, you know, that we're really attached to, are usually the things we have to laboriously step through, detach ourselves from, burn away, release, you know, go through a process about them.
Mm.
So with that said, often it is our wounds that we have the strongest stories about.
Mm.
And that connects back to what you're saying.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we might have wounds that we don't have stories about, and that might be easier to let go of.
Right. I'll tell you, and when I think about, like, I have a very difficult, had a very difficult relationship with my father. He's, you know, mentally ill, et cetera, et cetera. And I had done a whole bunch of therapy and a whole bunch of internal healing and emotional work around him. And then suddenly, a whole bunch of stuff about him dropped away. And my husband and my brother were just amazed. And I wasn't married to my husband back then, but it was like one morning I woke up and I was perfectly at peace with all the craziness that my father brought, and they were just stunned. How did that happen? Couldn't exactly tell you. I can tell you that I did all the legwork. You know, I did a lot of legwork before that, but something at a certain point just was done, just dropped away.
Do things drop away when we feel safe letting them drop away?
From an awakening perspective, safety is a little irrelevant.
Really?
Yeah. Because when I'm fully in awakened awareness, safety or not safety it's part of the relative conditions of this world of form, and it doesn't kind of really matter.
But in order to get there, you kind of have to realize that it's not personal.
Yes. And maybe the answer to your question is that when we drop the story of safety, needing to be safe or not, like we're not grasping onto safety one way or another, maybe that's part of the opening to let things go. Because I would say, just using the story as an example, so we're not just talking in theoreticals, the piece about my dad, if I had remained attached to being safe with my father emotionally, good Lord, I am sure I would not have been able to let go of the rest of that stuff. You know what I'm saying? Because my father's pretty volatile and he's an angry guy. And so there's not a lot of safety when you're in his orbit in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm not trying to find safety, boy,
right.
Totally fine.
I get it.
Yeah.
I get it. That's actually, it's one of the interesting things that I've been doing recently in my healing work is taking people to a place where it's okay to feel the way they feel.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay to not want to feel the way they feel. It's okay to want to feel something else.
Yes.
And I couch that in the moment by saying, you're safe. And so all of these feelings are okay to feel. Getting them to a place where they can feel what they feel without needing to worry about their safety.
Right.
Right. And as you're describing it, it's less about feeling safe and more about not worrying about safety.
Yes, ultimately.
And when I reflect on that, that is a place that I can get to independently when I realize that my life is not about me, that it's not personal.
Yes.
Right, because, and we talked a bit before the break, and I want to come back to that. We talked about who is me when we say it's not personal? Who is the identifier of that which might be or might not be personal?
Mm-hmm.
And if you allow yourself to connect to as much as you can connect to and be one with as much as you can be one with, right? We're all mm-hmm. at different stages of that.
Mm-hmm.
Then the notion of it being personal starts to have a really weird tone to it, because it looks like a small, it looks like you're being small.
Right.
And yet we still have to function. We still have to eat. We still have our agency. We still have to do something in the world, because we have a body and we have talents and we have, I don't know, do we have obligations? I don't know. So what do we do with that part?
What do you do with that part? And that's a great question. Depending on the particular area of life that we're talking about, I could give you a slightly different perspective. But the bottom line is, first of all, now you get to look, when you're viewing the world through the lens of awakened awareness rather than the ego, you get to look at everything with a great amount of freedom, acceptance, and compassion. So
freedom, acceptance, and compassion.
And compassion. Mm-hmm. So now I can look at myself and all my gifts, talents, and shortcomings, right? And I can now see them through the lens of, okay, I'm free to embrace all that is inside this being called Sonia without shame, without judgment, without all this other stuff. That's freedom. I'm free to do whatever the universe calls me to do with these gifts, talents, and shortcomings. The acceptance is, I accept all that is. I accept this life as it is in this moment. It's not static. It's going to change. It's going to have to change, because life is in constant motion. It's in change. So I'm going to keep growing, but I accept all that is. And I'll tell you that if you get nothing else out of this interview, if all you do is a practice of accepting yourself just as you are, it is so powerful. It can change everything, because most egos spend their time either rejecting a part of themselves or wanting something more or holding on to some part of themselves. They never just peacefully accept. There's never a state of acceptance in the ego. But in truth, we can just accept. It's not a passive state in that we give up on change, quite the opposite. When you accept what is, you have even more potential for change.
Because you're not pretending that it isn't.
Exactly. And there's no filter of some sort of illusion of perfection or imperfection or any of it. You're just accepting what is.
Yeah.
So then the compassion piece is really, again, not only an acceptance for all that is, but just love. And that love is not the same kind of love that I experienced personally as an ego, like loving someone else. And that love was tainted by trying to get something out of the deal of love and all the stuff that comes with ego love. It's just love. It's just the simplest, humblest love for all that is. So I can have a tremendous compassion for this body, Sonia, that has back pain one day and is totally feeling great another day, or does whatever it does. There's just compassion, and then that compassion extends out to everyone else around me. So that's the theoretical piece, and then we can talk about some specific examples of how this moves in the world. But go ahead with your question,
John.
Well,
I was just, thinking about the compassion, and I know that I have challenges with this, and I'm certain that other people do. It's that in the presence of what appears to be evil and suffering in the world,
mm-hmm.
having love and compassion for all of it is hard.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it shouldn't be hard if you're looking at it through the right lens, because if you're looking at it through the lens of equanimity,
mm-hmm.
where you're not judging it, then you can allow that there's a story that the divine knows that you don't, that makes all of this fit together.
Right.
But that's kind of a theoretical love. Is there a more visceral way to love?
Yes. When you're talking specifically about that example, I think it's a good example and a question I get often. So we have axe murderers and Hitler and whoever, and How do we even dare experience love for those beings? Like, is it even okay to? Like, how does that work? So first of all, start with acceptance. So we're not going to fight against the truth that Hitler existed. It just was what it was. Okay, so we just have to accept what is. Underneath that, when you step out from the very individual example of Hitler and you just see the whole world, the whole ecosystem of our world, there's just a love for all that comes, all that's destructive, all that's life-giving. It's all part of one world, and the life-giving part can't exist without the destructive part. So there's love for it. But there's a really, really, really important piece to this that where I think most ego minds get confused, which is that we associate in some twisted misunderstanding of codependency, I think, this notion that if we love someone, we condone them for their behaviors.
And or want to preserve them.
Or we, you know, want to make them feel okay, or we want to help them in the world in some way. Real love is capable of intense boundaries. Real love is incapable of fire. Real love is capable of immense nurturing. Real love is capable of all of it. It's just whatever's in truth. So I was using the example the other day with a friend of mine. You know, I was in the woods with my husband up in Yosemite at Tuolumne Meadows. We're hiking up to Dog Lake. And we get up to the top of Dog Lake, and it's beautiful, and it's gorgeous and so peaceful. And then this bear comes walking around the corner, literally coming right at us.
Wow.
And it's a huge bear. It's the biggest bear I've ever seen. And we're like, oh my God. And we're yelling at it, and we're trying to tell it to go away, and it just isn't caring. So I closed my eyes, and I tried to connect in with the bear's consciousness. This is the benefit of being a psychic, right? But I was connecting in with the bear's consciousness.
Don't try this at home.
Yes, don't try this at home. Exactly. Don't close your eyes when a bear's nearby, first of all. And second of all.
Professional driver on a closed course.
Yes. So my husband was yelling and shouting, and I closed my eyes just for a second, and I connected in with the bear's consciousness, and I could feel my immense love for this bear. And then I said to the bear, go. But it was like a shout in my mind. I was like, you must go. Like, this is not okay. You must leave. I mean, it was a really intense boundary. Like, my own mother bear came out, right? And I felt the bear say to me or communicate something along the lines of, I was about to go anyway. And I open my eyes, and the bear stands up on his hind legs, turns in the opposite direction of where he was coming towards us, and runs into the woods away from us. And I was like, wow, what a teaching the bear spirit gave me about setting a boundary, right? That's how love moves. I love this bear, and I do not want it anywhere near me to eat me for dinner, right?
That's pretty complicated. That's cool. That's very cool, though. That's great.
But just to bring the point home that you can love something, you can love a movement of the universe and not like it, not condone it, not have to baby it along, not, you know, none of it. Does that make sense?
I think we're going to get a lot of questions on this.
I'm sure we will.
Okay, so we're about out of time. Is there anything you want to leave us with or final thoughts?
Yeah, I'm moved to say what's coming through me to say is that if you feel a niggling inside of yourself of this awakened awareness, or even if you've had the beginnings of awakenings in your life, I support you to trust it. And I support you to discover for yourself what it means to be a new human. It looks different for everyone. There's no one person that's the ultimate example of what living an awakened life looks like. It's so specific and unique to you. And in support of your journey, I have a bunch of resources online that are free if they need them too. So we can talk about that as well. So not to leave people on this cliffhanger, like there's no way for them to have some access to exploring some of these topics. There's a bunch of resources online too.
Great, great. Yeah. So what are the best ways for people to reach you?
Quickest and easiest is probably to go to my website where you can sign up on my mailing list. And if you sign up on my mailing list, you're going to get links to a free audio of Becoming a New Human. It was an introductory talk I gave in Los Angeles called The Impact of Awakening to Big Love. You'll get access to an audiobook, which is I'm Not a Monk, Working and Making Money While Waking Up. It covers a lot of topics, including accepting your gifts, a surprisingly selfless path, which we sort of started getting into.
Okay, you're going to come back and talk about that.
Okay, we can talk about that. And you can have a free 30-minute introductory private consultation with me, a private session, so you can taste my private work. And you can sign up at www.illuminatedwisdom.com. That's illuminatedwisdom.com.
And we'll have that on the website.
Great. Awesome.
Okay. And that's the best way for folks to get to you right now?
Yeah. They can also go to my Facebook page. It's Illuminated Wisdom. Mm-hmm. And all that information is on there, too. You can always email me, Sonya, S-O-N-Y-A, at illuminatedwisdom.com.
Excellent. Sonya, thank you very much for coming in and talking with me. I had a great time, learned a ton, as always, and I can't wait to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
John, you're a blast. Thank you so much.
Okay, talk soon. We'll be right back.
Firefly Willows LIVE is proud to support Mikaboo Companion Bird Rescue. Founded in 1996 and operating throughout the greater San Francisco Bay Area, Mikaboo is a rescue organization for parrot type and other domesticated companion birds. Their volunteers, the heart and soul of Mikaboo, are dedicated to rescuing companion birds who have been neglected, abused, injured, or surrendered to them, with the ultimate goals of rehabilitation and rehoming these feathered beings. Mikaboo offers bird education classes to people interested in adopting a rescue bird, as well as to the general bird-loving public. Find them at www.mikaboo.org. Mikaboo is spelled M-I-C-K-A-B-O-O. Or email them at mail@mikaboo.org. Information on how to make a donation to help the birds can be found at www.mikaboo.org or by emailing donations@mikaboo.org. M-I-C-K-A-B-O-O. This tip of the week from Mikaboo Companion Bird Rescue. Did you know that an all-seed diet is bad for your pet birds? A balanced parrot diet includes pellets, fruits, and vegetables, but no chocolate or avocado. Gravel is unnecessary. See your veterinarian or go to Mikaboo's reading room on the web for dietary advice, including how to convert your parrot to a healthier diet. Mikaboo's website is mikaboo.org. That's M-I-C-K-A-B-O-O.org.
Welcome back. This is Convergence, and I'm your host, John Carosella. With me now is a special guest, Zlata Dolgova. She's a friend and a colleague of mine who is also a teacher of Qigong and yoga. For the last 2 years, Zlata has been traveling the world and doing intensive study of the more esoteric forms of Qigong and yoga in China and Russia. We're happy to have her back in the Bay Area, only back like 2 weeks ago. And we look forward to hearing where she establishes herself and her practice. So welcome, Zlata. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you.
You've been gone a long time, and I've missed you terribly. In fact, I particularly missed getting massages from you. So hopefully that's something that you're going to establish as well when you get back here.
Oh, this is a big part of the whole practice, holistic.
Good. So tell us a little bit, where did you go and what did you learn while you were gone?
First of all, I would like to start just a couple of words about a very big feeling of discontent that I felt my whole life about myself and about life. And somehow I couldn't establish the relationships with the people, with myself in the first place. So I wanted to discover what's on the way for me just to have a happy and open life, to live openly. And why yoga? Because whatever I would go in the very beginning, I wouldn't find the answer. So everything is the same, everything is repetitive. And one day I just accidentally walked in the class in the gym where yoga was, and something about the environment shifted immediately in me, that something was different, that any sport, any other places, any mental teachings, what I was heard by the time.
What was that shifted feeling? What was it?
It just sparked my attention. I was not storing in myself and constantly thinking in myself, judging and thinking about my problems. That was, I didn't know at that time what it was, but now looking back, I can say that was the first experience of the openness, that you're actually open to the world. I was blessed that my yoga teacher was not just a yoga instructor, as there are many there, but she was a real teacher. And she presented this atmosphere, this energy that actually created the opening inside of me. And how I experienced this opening? That was a feeling of expansion, the feeling of the attention from inside of me going out there. I'm learning and expanding, and I want to be that. I want to grow. I want to expand. There was a feeling of that there is something much more here that I ever knew.
Okay.
So I did my few movements in yoga, the first one, and I was so ashamed of myself that I immediately moved back on the last row so nobody would see me. So clumsy and ridiculous my body, as I judged myself, was. So this is how it began. So in exploring with the yoga more, as my body was lack of flexibility, as I begin to discover that part of my discontent and unhappiness with myself was a lot related to the mental view, how I view and how I see myself and how I view life. So the first benefit, I began to attend the classes, I began to learn about the teachers and the deep aspects of yoga. So the first comes the physical level. And the first benefit I received from these classes and these experiences was tremendous physical opening. My body began to change the form, but not only that, my body began to change its shape, and it's not about weight or how it looks like, it really began to open up. And that opening in my body would create the different feeling about myself, not as myself, as I know myself, but feeling inside how I feel about life. And this feeling strongly affected my relationship with people. And that was the cause why I choose to explore the connection. I began to see how I see myself in a limited way and how I project what I see about myself to other people and how actually that impacts my relationship with other people and the work that I do.
So you had a sense of that there was a big difference between the open you that you were experiencing, you know, that you were starting to experience as you did yoga, and the story of you that you had been carrying around.
Yes.
And as you did more yoga, you found that the practice of yoga itself was shifting your perception of yourself.
The first yoga started to shift my perception how I feel in my body. And with the practice, it didn't happen in the first day. In my first times, I just enjoyed the physical sense and I feel much easier to move around and I have a more uplifting feelings of life and myself. It's not thinking of myself. It was just a feeling. And eventually, it began to expand and impact the relationship with other people, and I began to see my limitations through yoga practices because I began to explore how the physical affects the mental aspect. And I began to become aware of the strong judgments and how did it happen. For example, I do practice of yoga and I open myself. I feel very open. I feel limitless. The feeling I get, oh, I can do anything, whatever, it's all possible and capable. And then I go outside in life right after the class and I get myself into a situation and suddenly I feel collapsed. And I can't neglect or ignore the shift of the feeling that actually encouraged me to look deeper. What was why in the yoga I felt so open in completely, and suddenly in this situation, what caused my feelings to collapse and become tense again? And that sparked the curiosity I needed to explore. I needed to learn that I knew that's me who is doing it to myself. So, and then I began to see that there is a whole mental part. So thanks for yoga. Yoga allowed me, actually, yoga gave me this opportunity to see the mental judgments where I judge myself and limit myself. So I don't continue the situation. I wouldn't allow the situation expand because of whatever is limiting my fears, my judgments of myself. And because I had this experience in yoga classes, I was able to see the collapse part. To compare, I could say that before that, living within that, within this collapsing feelings, that's what I believe the reality is.
Mm-hmm.
That's how yoga creates the opening. So I'm not going to say that I became immediately happy in life, but the first that brought into my attention to see the difference and experience.
Mm.
That in yoga, in classes, I can achieve that opening, complete opening, that feeling, that ability that I'm capable for many things. I'm capable, I'm content, I can expand, I can explore. And suddenly I step in situation and it just shuts down.
So in yoga you experience the dissolving of resistance.
Dissolving, yes, that's a very good way to say it.
And then when you stepped out of yoga, you experienced all those resistances again.
Exactly.
And so naturally, your curiosity is like, why did that happen?
Right. Why I cannot prolong and carry this feeling through every moment of my life? What actually makes that experience of opening shut down again?
So, did you discover the answer?
I'm in the process of that. But definitely, the more I go into this direction, the more I discover, the more interesting journey it becomes. It's not any more shocking, miserable, painful experience of seeing myself and judging myself. So my first discovery was a strong connection of yoga as a physical part and the body itself, and how the body, the structure of the body, how this physical structure connect and relate to our mental structure. So the last 2 years I've been traveling, that was my emphasis. How, through the physical movement, the asana, I can bring to the awareness or shine the light into my mental limitations that came with adaptation process in the society. We all have that. How it limits me, how to move beyond that, how to become aware of that first, and how to move beyond that, unfold and open myself in a deeper level.
So, and how does Qigong relate to this exploration?
How does Qigong relate? That's about the awareness. You become aware of your physical body. You begin to breathe. Naturally, with the movement and with the breath, the body begins to relax. And in the moments when the body relaxes, because the mental and the spiritual is connected to the physical, your awareness begins to expand. So if you continue to expand in this movement, the more you breathe, the more the body relaxes, the inner space, and we have the inner space and we have the outer space. I want to bring this terminology. The outer space is the space of the object, what we see actually in the physical form. The inner space, it's our state of mind, state of being, the feelings or the sensations of the energy about the object. So my awareness of my body begins to expand. And my sensitivity to the outer reality, to the object, also begins to expand. It becomes bigger, sharper. I sense the outer world. So then I come to that state of opening. Let's say there is a situation that I want to work with. Then I, in that place of expansion and opening through the Qigong movement, I bring as the memory of the situation or the object that creates the tension for me and as an obstacle in my mind. I bring it into my inner space because I have that expansion right now with the practice. And if I bring this object into my inner space, I become aware of the tension that caused within my body by this object. The object caused a certain tension. It can be another person, it can be situation, it can be my co-workers, it can be any situation. So once I begin to be aware of the tension that can come as a feeling or resistance, I become aware of my judgment about this object. And that I can see that not the object or the person or the situation caused me the collapse and tension, but my judgment about this object caused me to construct and become small and resistant. So then if I continue, I become aware and I feel it in my body, so I have this object, another person or whatever, and I have the awareness of how it is felt in my body, and I continue my practice of Qigong with the breath, like I can breathe in the area. I'm aware that, okay, I feel the tension in my solar plexus or my chest. The emotion comes with that. Usually, as it was before the practice, I would immediately act out of this emotion, and it would never lead to resolving or success. Never. So what I want to alter my inner space to expand my awareness of that my reaction about the subject. We call it healing also, or we call it letting go. What I do, becoming aware of the tension and my judgments, I simply learn to let it go, not to be trapped in it, not to act out of that, but just to be aware of that. Now, the next step of the physical practice, we call it physical, but it's actually spiritual. The more I continue the practice and keep in this awareness, actually I dissolve the tension in my inner space, and it comes to the dissolving the tension in the muscles. In yogi tradition, they call it burning the impurities in the body. That's exactly the sutras. You practice asana, then you practice hard asana, Uttita Trikonasana, or warrior. We know this asana that that implies the strength in the body. And we use the muscles tension. It's strong asana. But the more we practice one asana for 2 minutes, for 1 minute, it becomes meditative. And in this moment, we begin to relax within this asana, keeping the awareness about the tension. Just simply open the body, that becomes to dissolve and transform. The actual transformation happens. And I allow this tension to dissolve. I'm letting go. I'm letting go of the judgment because I see that this is my judgment. This is my limitation. I act out of that. And I see the object that creates the tension within me. So I am creating my reality out of this tension. I work and I let go of the tension. My body begins to change. My mind begins to change. And I don't see this person, this object, or this situation as a threat any longer. And that freedom allows me to communicate differently. So my reality changes. Usually it brings so much freedom, interaction, as soon as the fear is gone, that actually the creative part comes out of that.
That's fantastic. So you mentioned strength, the strength of the warrior.
That's an example, yes.
I've been recently exploring strength as a way of dealing and coping with challenges in life. And, you know, of course, it's fairly obvious that if you're strong, you can endure things. You can be present in discomfort and challenge if you have strength. But there's another aspect of coping or of making one's way in the world that I've been recently coming to understand more fully, and that is the aspect of alignment.
Mm-hmm.
And I am starting to realize that strength and alignment together are much more powerful than either one alone.
Alignment.
Yeah. And then I realized yoga is a discipline of strength and alignment. And, you know, on the physical level, it's a discipline of strength and alignment. But, of course, it's much more than that. So can you share a little bit more about the roles of mm-hmm. those two aspects?
Strength and alignment. So that's the first part when we learn yoga art. On the physical level, alignment is necessary because all the joints are connected with each other. If we have misalignment in the hips, it will immediately affect on the shoulders and the neck, all this interconnectedness in the physical body. And if we use the hips in incorrect way, if we don't pay attention, if we are not aware how we position the hip, then it will affect the joints on the knees and the ankles. If we practice, let's say, downward facing dog, this simple pose, if we don't know how to position our palm, and palm, it's a point, a focal point, many points that connect to the floor, and we press the body. So if we don't know how many points are connected and how to distribute the weight in the palm, that will affect the wrist and the shoulders. So many people, and because, as you mentioned, yes, I'm doing massages, and I have many clients who come to me from practices yoga just because they put so much attention into the being strong, look good, have beautiful muscles, and to be attractive for the eyes, that they neglect. And also there is another part, the mental part, and I want to answer the question multidimensionally. The mental part is huge here. We want to be beautiful, we want to look good, we compare. The mental part is because they focus on their purpose about the yoga, why they practice yoga, to look good, to become strong. They don't have awareness, the full awareness expanded on the body. These two things don't exist together. In the moment you expand your awareness in your body and you want to come to alignment, you don't think about comparing yourself with others.
Oh, that's really good.
So in the moment we want to expand, then we practice alignment. That means our mind and our awareness is inside of the body. Expand as much as it can go. In yogi tradition, they say every cell in the body has its own intelligence. This is how we expand our awareness.
So you suggest that alignment is bringing the awareness inside the body. But isn't strength also an internal awareness? You know, when we're doing a yoga pose, when we're in an asana and we're exerting ourselves.
That's a part of that, but not all of that. It's only the part of that. So if I want to be strong, just the feeling of this word, strong, that's a focus. I want my muscles to be strong. Alignment brings much more subtle details that don't relate to strength. If I'm focused on strength, I will miss that. Why would I be focused on strength? Because I have some concept in my mind. If I focus on my body, only on the strength, that means because the mind and the physical is connected. I have a priority and limitations in my mind focusing on achieving some goal, for example. That's analogy of the mental to the physical strength part. That's very important, but it's not all of that. If I allow my awareness to expand on alignment, what happens? It takes one thing that I notice in classes, in many yoga classes, competition. The minds are competing with each other. Who is stronger? Who can more hold the poses? Who does it more cool? As soon as the mind begins to work this way, as soon as it happens in the mind, awareness shuts down. These two don't exist together. So if I shift my attention on more expanding into the each cell in my body, I will know right away I want to adjust my body and I will look less cool as I look than I'm strong because I become aware of much more subtle levels of the joints, of the vertebrae in my spine. And I can see if I go so deep and force myself so much, I actually damage myself. So in life, the analogy in life of the physical strength, the mental focus. And we have an idea, if I totally focus, I will achieve my goal. I'm so focused on my goal. If I lose my awareness of the subtleties in the body, in the joints, the subtle muscles, the inner bodies, the sensations, that means then I go forward to reach my goal. I lose my awareness about the environment and the others. And the same as in yoga, I damage myself because I'm so absorbed in being strong. The same I create by achieving my goal in more subtle levels, the causal plane or the mental plane that cause pain to environment. And if I reach my goal by cause of pain of environment, I will never reach my goal. That's a big mistake, and it will be cause that will come back to me one way or another, and I will experience that. That's why how important alignment is. It increases sensitivity that starts in the physical body. And if I'm a serious practitioner, if I practice yoga seriously, if I want to be a yoga as a part of my learning of life, I will expand these lessons in yoga in each situation I go through. And then I will know limitations in my mind. Then I would stop blaming others and judging myself. That is the responsibility. That's all how these levels are connected to each other. So in the physical body, and yoga has five bodies. They call five koshas, the awareness expands from the physical to the highest intelligence, through the astral, emotional, mental, and highest intelligence planes. So alignment in the physical plane gives the health and actually the strengthening the whole system of the body that's in a physical form. Then we have the body properly aligned, the energy flows freer. That's energetical level. Once we have the energy flow free in the body, we have immediately emotional and mental releases, letting go happening right away. That's what alignment on yoga practice. And yet, also, this is the teaching how to carry the alignment and the sense of alignment with the situation. Because alignment is possible, then I can feel the body. And then I have that receptivity. This is the female part, the yin part that we talked about. So I have the sensitivity that starts with my body. I am sensitive to my body. I am not, I forgot the word, I am not absorbed the idea to look like and be first in the class. But I am into that sense of expand awareness as far as possible, become aware of my every cell in my body. Then I go, that's an awareness part, that's a flexibility, that's listening. I'm listening to my body. So in life situation, I'm listening to the environment. That's the yin part, listening, awareness, becoming aware, pause for a moment before I take the next action, and the next movement would be the yang part, and then I stop again and I listen. If in the yoga practice, in the class, in actually asana practice, I move into the asana and then I stop for a moment. I pause. I listen how my body responds. Then I know if I can go forward, I go again. Now I'm aware I reach the limit. With the idea of competing and look good, I would go far beyond this moment and I will damage myself. This is a metaphor for life situation and relationship. That's how multidimensional it is. So I stop and then listen. I feel it. This is a yin part, the feminine part. Then I go stronger forward. This is a masculine part, the movement expanding in the physical. Then I pass again. This is how yin and yang go together. So we embrace in the life situations. I listen to the environment. I'm aware of the other people's responses, of the tree responses, of the sun and the clouds, whatever, animals, of everything what's around me. And I move forward. And I listen again, and I move forward. And then I achieve my goal. This is far greater achievement if I just go using the strength and the focus. It's the more, focus is the masculine part.
More balanced and more benign in achieving.
More benign that benefit, everyone benefits.
Yeah.
And that's what why the yoga calls spiritual practice, because spirituals, part of it is that not you just benefit and you have your goal, but everyone is benefit around you while you're achieving your goal.
Mm.
That's a spiritual part of it.
So this is a beautiful teaching that the role of alignment in yoga is a reminder and a discipline and an awakening to sensitivity, receptivity to the environment.
That's correct.
And so I'm thinking about the divine masculine and divine feminine, strength and alignment.
Mm-hmm.
That strength is the masculine.
Yes.
And alignment is the feminine.
Right.
And so when we were speaking earlier, before we were on the air, you talked about something called the yin point.
Yes, and the yin point would be pause, listening, feeling. It's a pause before the movement.
Is it possible to be in the yin point at all times? Or is it a goal?
Most of the time. So the yin is present within the yang. So the yin is you, then you expand your awareness, you pause, you sense the moment. Then the yang, the movement forward. This is the masculine part. Then you move forward. Let's say in martial art, let's take an example of the martial art. The yin part, then the martial artist is standing and he's sensing before the movement happens. Eventually, his yin becomes so powerful that he barely moves. Nobody even sees his movement. So there is great power in the yin. But yin, it's not just be still and do nothing. That's not yin. It's yin, it's an awareness. And then the active part from the physical activity is moved into the internal part, awareness. That's what yin is. I'm aware of the environment, and I know exactly then the movement for the martial art needs to be done. That's the yin part. The movement itself is the yang part. So we are learning to balance both. And the only way then the martial artist can achieve his success, then he's not attached to be the most strongest one. Then he's not attached to the strength. The same in yoga. If I'm so much attached to the strong and be the strongest and be the best in the class, I lose the yin part.
In a way, as you talk about this, being the best or being the strongest, I think the contrast is between being the best or the strongest and being completely myself.
That's right. That's the yin balanced. Completely myself in the moment. So in the moment, then I let go the idea of strength as something that is the only what brings me to my goal, the only part. If I think like that, if I have this idea in mind that strength, that's all what needed, then I lose the yin part, and I'm losing myself to be in the present moment.
I lose
the sensitivity and I lose the awareness because I'm absorbed by the idea of strength.
Mm-hmm.
Strength is necessary. It's very important. We say that healthy spirit in the healthy body and the strong body. The body has to be strong. Never ever would that part would be diminished. The only is just a part of what the whole is, what the holistic is, a part of it.
So there's a third aspect of yoga that you touched on at the very beginning of our conversation. So we have strength, we have alignment. What role does flexibility play?
That's the opening part. The more body becomes open, the flexibility comes right away. And the way to create this flexibility, there is no way to apply strength for that. That actually breaks the body. So the flexibility comes only when the one learns the opening. The analogy of the body opening is the mind open-minded. That's an analogy in how it reflects on the mental side. And how you become more flexible, you simply go into pose, you're aware of how far you can go, and then you begin to relax within the strength. That's how they two come together. So you keep the strong, you extend yourself, that's the masculine part, you extend yourself. And in this part, you're aware, you listen how far you can extend yourself, a little bit beyond the comfort zone, and then you begin to relax. And in this moment of relaxation and letting go of the tension, the flexibility comes that caused the opening in the mind.
So in a way, you rely on your strength to allow yourself to relax.
You can say that, but this is one way to say that. Rely on your strength, that means the strength has to develop first. That's how it sounds. That's the energy of the phrase comes.
Mm-hmm.
If I rely on my strength, but that's not necessary. Yes, it can be this way, but it's not necessary. It can be the other way around as well. You develop flexibility and you rely on the flexibility to create the strength. You can go from either side. They're equal.
So I actually want to explore this. This is important. So if I don't know, so how do I rely on my flexibility to develop my strength?
Well, if you're flexible, you can go deeper in the pose. You're not, you don't have that back mind to hurt yourself. You're flexible enough so you can focus on the strength. If you're flexible, you won't pull your tendons, if we speak of the physical level.
Mm-hmm.
If we speak of the mental level, it's slightly different. But if you come back to the physical point, like I don't have to be worried that I damage myself. I can pretty freely move my body around and see what strength, what level, what muscles I want to develop and focus on that. That gives some kind of freedom to move.
I'm getting, if I have that kind of flexibility, then it's unlikely that I would get into a situation where I would hurt myself.
That's less.
Right?
It doesn't mean it's not going
to
happen.
No, right. But the metaphor, the analogy to the mental would be, if I'm flexible, then there's a good chance that I can explore different intentions, different focus.
That's right.
Without being at risk.
Yes.
With being at much lower risk.
Much lower risk, yes. But if you don't have strength, that flexibility has its own, it's like doesn't have a direction. Strength does a direction to flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they both have to come together. For example, it's almost you lose your focus. They don't
right.
exist without each other. So strength is never, ever less important than flexibility.
Mm. Okay, so we have strength, alignment, and flexibility.
Yes.
And the flexibility is the open-mindedness.
Yes, that's an analogy of the mental plane.
And it's the opening, and it's an opening or relaxing in the physical practice?
That's what you have to practice if you want to expand. And the same situation, if you want a situation to develop, the true creativity comes with a relaxing mind. That's an analogy of the mental plane. It's all yoga. It's also yoga. So we just kind of join them together. Yes, you have to relax.
And the flexibility in the mental plane kind of brings us back to the beginning, which was the release of judgment.
That's a release of judgment, absolutely. Releases of judgment cause the flexibility in the body and creativity in the spirit and the mind. The creation comes from that. Judgment creates the tension in the body and a lack of flexibility. This is how these bodies are, how they relate to each other.
That's great. Okay, well, we're about out of time.
Okay.
Is there any last thought you want to share with our audience?
This is endless journey, and in my experience, the more I learn about that, the more expanded I feel and how I can apply and use it in my life from that place. That's what I started sharing my story. And I was very discontent. This is how I started to explore what else. It has to be something more in life. And it just became an incredible journey. It's never end. It's just more expansion. That's a beautiful part of that practice.
Okay, so if folks want to reach you to connect with you about massage or yoga class or qigong, or could you do private sessions as well?
Yes.
How might they best get in touch with you?
Right now, in this moment, since it's my second week here, the best place would be reached by phone. The phone is 408-887-7316.
And do you have an email address that you would also welcome inquiries?
Yes, I do. zjustice29@gmail.com.
Okay, zjustice29@gmail.com. And
yes.
We'll have that on the website for people as well.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, Zlata, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us this morning. And we look forward to seeing you out there and enjoying your practices.
That was enjoyable. Thank you very much.
And we'll be right back. And now, a personal note and reflection. During the production of this show, since I last joined you on Convergence, my father had a stroke and passed away. He was 89. He lived his life independently until the end, and left us after a brief period where, while hospitalized, many friends and family came to sit with him and reflect on life, memories, and past experiences. Needless to say, this event has been a powerful one for me and my family, and we have all been doing our own reflecting. My father was many things. He was disciplined. He was dignified. He was a hard worker and lived a life of service. As a dutiful son, as a serviceman in World War II, as a father to 6 children, as a teacher, guidance counselor, and principal, as a superintendent and civil servant, always in service to education, as a caregiver to my ailing mother, and as a mentor and guide to us, his adult children, and to all who needed a hand, compassionate advice, or a philosophical perspective. He was loved as a friendly, open-hearted man with a great sense of humor. We heard that most often from those who came to offer condolences. When it was time to write the obituary, one of my sisters took to the task. When she finished, we all marveled at how broad were my father's interests and how much he had done. Of course, we knew all this, but as is human nature, we didn't always reflect on it all. But reading his obituary, we and many who came to call marveled that he had done so much. More, we marveled that he had done so much and said so little about it. What emerged for me as perhaps the final lesson my father had to offer me was a great, deep, tranquil humility. A humility that in retrospect was obvious, but for much of my life I mistook for lack of ambition or disinterest or complacency. But it wasn't. Sure, my father wasn't perfect. He could be stubborn, and especially in his later years, cantankerous. But that humility, invisible to me then, unfathomable to me now. I suspect I will be ruminating on this, working on this lesson, for years to come. What have I been discovering so far? What my father seems to have known early on. That in applying my gifts and talents, in pursuing goals and objectives, in trying to live my life to the fullest, it's not about me. I see now in all those selfless acts of compassion, in the generous acts of support, my father gave of his gifts and from his blessings, but without the idea that he would be recognized or noted. He acted out of mercy, not pride. Whether it was the nameless needy served by a local charity or a relative that was, for one reason or another, out of favor, my father held them close to his heart. No one was ostracized. No one was left out. The day after the funeral, my wife, daughter, and I were driving from our hotel to the family home to gather for quiet conversation with my brothers and sisters. On the way, I was compelled to stop at the gravesite. A hawk greeted us as we approached the cemetery. We parked the car and walked over to the grave. Brown dirt, grass seed, and flowers from the funeral home had replaced the fixtures that accompany the casket and vault, and the large pile of dirt that is the inevitable final embrace of Mother Earth. We stood quietly, my daughter, wife, and I, listening to the cawing of crows, feeling the gentle September breeze. "Excuse me," there was a voice at my elbow. "Are you his son?" A humbly dressed man, perhaps in his early 40s, a bit gritty from his work, had walked up to us from behind. "Yes," I said. "Your father was a really great guy. I've been working here for 20 years, and he was always very friendly and kind. I know you probably don't want to get to know a guy like me, but I just wanted to say that he was a really kind man." I asked him his name, shook his hand, and thanked him. Respectful of our purpose, he turned to make his way back to the lawn tractor. And then, once more, "He was a really great guy, Joe was." How many of us take the time to get to know the groundskeeper at the cemetery? What my father seems to have known early on in living his life to the fullest, what I'm going to try to learn, apply, and remember, is that it's not about me. Thanks for joining us. I hope you enjoyed our program. We're available for further conversations. If you have any questions or want to join the discussion, find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fireflywillows, or send us a note through the Contact Us tab at fireflywillows.com. Thanks again.
To learn more about today's guest or one of the topics discussed, go to fireflywillows.com/live. And for more information about Firefly Willows LIVE upcoming shows, visit our page at blogtalkradio.com/fireflywillows LIVE. Thank you for joining us on today's episode of Firefly Willows LIVE. We hope you enjoyed the show. Join us next week as Heisey Luckmers and Mildred Lynn McDonald host our live on-air readings call-in show. Call in or listen as our hosts use their tools of psychic messages, tarot, intuitive coaching, animal medicine, and energy healing to offer guidance for your life's path. This is Deb Caracella. Please join us next Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Pacific Time on Firefly Willows LIVE Blog Talk Radio.